Mr. Crone.
May it please the Court, my name is David Picaret Crone, and along with my co-counsel, Allison Shaw, we represent Joseph Stock under 7-Eleven licenses through the Northwestern University School of Law. The key issue in this case is that Mr. Stock's right to confront was violated when a trial court completely cut off his opportunity to impeach critical testimony against him. There are three things I want to highlight today. First, that impeachment is a critical part of the right to confront that cannot be trumped by evidentiary law. Second, that the testimony in Najera was critical and indispensable for the state's case against Mr. Stock. And finally, that the impeaching the credibility of Najera's testimony is critical for Mr. Stock to have a full and fair defense.
So, Mr. Crone, even if all of those things are correct, I've reread these excerpts that you think should have come in several times, and they're really quite ambiguous. I don't find it overwhelming on the side of the state, where he says, you didn't tell anybody else, you know what I'm saying. I mean, that's very elliptical. But on the other hand, I don't see the tell anybody what as overwhelming either. So I think we have to place this in the spectrum of things that are real confrontation clause problems that we agree with everything you say. I mean, confrontation clause is a constitutional provision. Impeachment is important. But this is such an ambiguous little exchange. It's hard for me to see how it would have influenced the jury's assessment of Najera or anything else.
Your Honor, the exchange you talk about was dealt with in the motion to clarify. The original motion in limine prevented defense counsel from asking about other statements. So, for example, Najera's response, yeah, I know, doesn't mean anything for the jury. But when they know that it's in response to Mr. Stock saying, they ain't got nothing, I didn't do nothing, you know that, all of a sudden it's clear that Najera is affirming Stock's innocence on that call.
It's not clear. I mean, you know, these guys are speaking, as I said, elliptically to each other for whatever reason they are. Maybe that's just how they talk. Maybe there was this confession. You know, I don't know. There's a lot that's very strange about this case, but at the moment we aren't focusing on most of it. We're focusing on this alleged confrontation clause problem, and I'm having trouble seeing how that excerpt and the state court's treatment of it was so far out of the boundaries that you would be entitled to relief.
This phone call was not simply a phone call between these two guys. This was a phone call that the police set up, and they specifically told...
Right, they were hoping to get some confirmation of the confession, right?
And they told Najera, bring up this confession.
And Najera doesn't do it.
He doesn't do it, and he doesn't contradict Stock when he says he's innocent. So when Stock says, because I didn't do nothing, and I don't know who did, Najera says, hey, man, I got to get back to work, dude. So this goes against what the purpose of the call was and is a direct contradiction to what he says on the stand.
Well, I mean, the state trial court, is concerned about letting this in since it, of course, Mr. Stock doesn't take the stand, and it looks like just a prior exculpatory statement on Mr. Stock's part.
Your Honor, as was discussed in the trial court, the purpose was not to get the exculpatory statements in. It was the exculpatory statements were necessary context for Najera's bizarre replies. He says on the stand, Stock told me he did it. And then in this call, he's basically saying, Stock, I know you didn't do it. But the jury can't hear that very important information without knowing what it's in response to, without having Stock's context.
If this were a more forthcoming conversation, I think you'd have a better argument.
That may be, Your Honor, but there were many excerpts like this. The phone call went on for 5 to 10 minutes. There were multiple opportunities for Najera to raise this alleged confession, as he was specifically told to do by police. And he failed to do it, and he failed to contradict Mr. Stock when Stock exclaimed his innocence, and he actually affirmed his innocence through his responses. It's also
but
important
you don't think this is the only reason that Mr. Najera could have failed to do this. He you know, people don't always cooperate with the police. They don't always do what they say they're going to do. The state says, well, maybe he really didn't want to have something on a recording. He's afraid Stock was going to be angry with him. I mean, I find it hard to see that we've ruled out all other possible explanations for what Najera is saying other than those that favor Mr. Stock.
And that would have been great information for the jury to have when considering the credibility of Najera's testimony. And the state could have gotten back and said, why didn't you bring it up? Why did you affirm his innocence? And then the jury, based on Najera's responses, could have properly weighed the credibility of his testimony. But without that, without this coming in at all, they were unable to consider any of it.
Well, there was a very lengthy cross-examination of Najera, though.
There was a lengthy cross-examination, but it didn't get to the heart of the testimony itself. It got to some general credibility issues, but it didn't get to whether that testimony on the stand was credible or not. And the jury, like in Davis, was denied the information they needed to properly weigh that testimony. I see I'm in my rebuttal time. I just quickly want to point out how critical Najera was to the state's case, and that what the state calls compelling evidence was nothing more than inconclusive circumstantial evidence, and Najera was the linchpin that tied it together. This is especially true after the state's theory that Stock had taken the family car and killed Ms. Wagner that morning totally fell apart when the defense established that his mother had the car at the bank at the time. There was no physical evidence that tied Stock to the crime. It was much more consistent with multiple attackers. There was blood on all three floors, including on the front door handle leading out of the house. Yet there was no blood on the car, there was no blood on Stock's clothes, and that none of Stock's fingerprints were found on the driver's side of the car. Therefore, it was quite likely that Najera's testimony itself resulted in the conviction of an innocent man. And if there are no other questions, I'll save the balance of my time for rebuttal.
Certainly, counsel.
Morning, Your Honors. Counselors, Assistant Attorney General Garson Fisher on behalf of the respondent. I'd like to begin by responding to the series of questions that you were asking, Judge Wood. Contrary to petitioner's position, he had ample opportunity to cross-examine Najera and test his credibility. Najera's testimony was that petitioner had confessed to him, and he was cross-examined extensively regarding the credibility of that confession. He was cross-examined about inconsistencies in his in-court testimony and his statement to police. He was cross-examining regarding his failure to tell anyone else about the confession.
But it's so weird. I mean, he confesses to Najera, and the police leave this violent and dangerous man, presumptively, out there for 3.5 years. This is an odd case.
I don't deny, Your Honor, that the timeline of the investigation is unusual.
The police know that apparently this man stabbed somebody 186 times, and they just say, oh, well, easy come, easy go, you know, and they leave him out. I mean, there are things that do not add up in this case at all.
I'm not in a position to comment on why the timing of the investigation proceeded as it did.
Well,
but
it's
we
also
do know
the state court itself, which you cite in your summary of the facts, notes that at least it was the defense theory that the telephone lines were perhaps cut by an accomplice. I mean, there's a lot of the way this happens that isn't very consistent with a one-man theory.
A jury had the opportunity to, and this is where I think it comes back to the heart of the Confrontation Clause claim and why petitioner's claim fails, is because the jury did have the opportunity to hear the witnesses, present the evidence against the defendant, and the defendant had the opportunity to cross-examine those witnesses and impeach their credibility. He even had the opportunity to cross-examine him using his omission during this phone conversation. The trial court's ruling permitted the petitioner to ask the defendant about the telephone call, to present to the jury that a call was made, the sole purpose of which was to raise this confession and that the confession wasn't explicitly raised.
I understand that, but I guess on that, we're not here to review simple evidentiary rulings on the part of the state trial court, but it strikes me as quite inconsistent with the principle that if you're going to use part of an excerpt, you really need to use enough to put it in context for the trial court to have done this. Now, we're at habeas review. The state courts have forgiven this lapse, but I can certainly see why Mr. Stock had a problem with cutting things off right in medias res.
Well, actually, I think the impeachment value of the telephone call was could have been presented to the jury. Petitioner elected not to do so because he didn't elicit that impeaching fact, Nahara's omission during the phone conversation. But to the extent that using the petitioner's individual self-serving out-of-court statements as opportunities for Nahara to raise the confession has any additional value, its additional value as impeachment is marginal. Its value is the improper prejudicial weight that this least reliable kind of hearsay would have put in front of the jury. And I think looking at both the transcripts of the pretrial hearings as well as the trial court's ruling itself, it's clear that all the trial court did here was exercise the wide latitude that the Supreme Court says it has to limit cross-examination.
I know that that's what the court did. I'm just saying if you cut somebody off to deprive the listener of the full context of what's being said, you know, we could cut your argument off and you might be sounding like you were saying something that you're not saying at all because you might have had a follow-up sentence. And, you know, this is very well established in the law of evidence. As I say, the state courts have looked at this, but the restrictions the trial court seemed to think it needed to put on, I can understand why defense counsel thought that really deprived this of any utility.
Well, and indeed the answer to the question also deprived it of utility in that, as you alluded to, there is an oblique reference to the confession.
I don't know that that's an oblique reference to the confession or to football scores or anything else. I honestly don't have any idea when Harris says, you didn't tell anybody else, you know what I'm saying, because they come to court and then I look like you know.
Well,
now, honestly,
and
what does that mean?
The marginal value of such an ambiguous statement.
They speak very cryptically, is what you're
saying. Yes.
And the marginal value of a cryptic, ambiguous, oblique statement goes.
Which the state, in its brief, construed as a clear reference to the confession.
It was both parties at the pretrial hearings, both parties and the court agreed that was indeed a reference to the confession.
Well, except that Stock then says, tell anybody what, which maybe means it's not a clear reference to the confession. If there was never any such confession, and Nahara has made the whole thing up.
But as you say, if there was never any such confession, the tell anybody what is value lies in allowing the defendant to testify without taking the stand.
No, it just means you didn't tell anybody else, and Stock is asking, what is it that you're asking me, did I tell anybody about? I don't even know that that's exculpatory. I have no idea.
I agree, Your Honor, that there's ambiguity, that it is a cryptic conversation, and there are layers that are not so expressed. But where the question is, as here, whether it was objectively unreasonable for the appellate court to say that this trial court's ruling did not violate petitioner's confrontation clause rights, and where even if there were error, and again, I don't think there was a clear violation of clearly established Supreme Court precedent, but even if there were error, where the burden in 2254 is on the petitioner to demonstrate that the error wasn't harmless, whether it's, as this court has instructed, first in the reasonable application of Chapman, and then even if that were not present, the application of Brecht, the very ambiguity and marginal value of this cryptic conversation goes to both of those points.
I guess all the blood was the victim's blood all over the house, because of course Mr. Stock doesn't have so much as a scratch on him.
That's correct, Your Honor, and the physical evidence, indeed, the physical evidence standing alone, while sufficient to point the finger at petitioner, would not be overwhelming evidence.
It's thin. It's not. I mean, when you say the physical evidence, there is no physical evidence.
I apologize.
Aside from a couple of fingerprints in the car, and she used to be his girlfriend, and so his fingerprints could have been in the car. I see no physical evidence that ties him to this
crime. I meant to incorporate also the additional conversations that were overheard, a friend hearing
right,
him
threatened. Right, the angry conversations. I understand you had that.
And, you know, regardless of the ruling that had been made by the trial court, there was never a scenario in which the confession would not have come in. The only question is, would the additional marginal value of impeachment, of using the specific examples, be so significant as to demonstrate that their absence had an injurious effect on the outcome? And the real value of those statements is the improper prejudicial value, because he could have, under the trial court's ruling, gotten in the general impeachment by omission that he sought, namely that with a phone conversation, the sole purpose of which was to raise the confession, he never expressly does. So the additional marginal value, when, as you alluded to in one of your questions, there are myriad reasons that he might not have expressly raised it. He might not have wanted to cooperate with police. He might have thought that petitioner suspected he was cooperating with police and been afraid to confirm that to the petitioner. So the marginal additional impeachment value is not sufficient to demonstrate the standard under Brecht. I see my time is up, so if the court has no additional questions, I would just ask that it affirm the district court's judgment denying habeas relief.
Very much. Anything further, Mr. Carcrone?
Yes, I just have a couple points to make. First of all, the jury was not satisfied with what they heard. They wanted the transcript. In deliberations, they sent a note to the judge asking for a number of things. One of them was the call with Joe, the taped call with Joe between Najera and Joe. Second, the state wants to focus on this exchange of tell anybody what, tell anybody else. The impeaching statement was that Stock confessed. That was the impeachable fact. That is what the purpose of bringing this in was to show, that he said on the stand, Stock said he did it, but in the call he said, I know Stock didn't do it. On the tell anybody what, there was no option for the court, for the defense counsel to raise that, to bring up that question, because he played it out for the court and he knew that the judge's mechanistic ruling would have provided a distorted view of that conversation for the jury. It wasn't just tell anybody what, but the important exchange then was the fact that Najera says anything, making it somewhat clear that tell anybody else isn't a reference to the confession. It's a reference to, I don't know, anything. To the extent that this was a cryptic conversation, that is what is for the jury to decide, for the jury to understand what was said and try to determine, resolve the ambiguities in those statements. Finally, the state talked about the appellate court applying Chapman reasonably, but it's clear that they did not apply Chapman reasonably, because they said, although they quoted the language, if error was harmless beyond a reasonable doubt, two sentences later they say, we cannot conclude such impeachment would have been outcome determinative, which is the opposite of beyond a reasonable doubt. And for these reasons, we ask that, because Mr. Stock was barred from confronting Najera with a direct contradiction of crucial testimony, we ask that Mr. Stock's petition for habeas corpus be granted. Thank you.
Thank you very much, counsel. And we appreciate your willingness and that of the Northwestern Clinic to accept the appointment in this case and the assistance you've been to the court as well as to your client. The case is taken under advisement.